Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Native people are dying from COVID at extraordinarily high rates across the country. According to the CDC, the pandemic has killed American Indians and Alaska Natives at nearly twice the rate of white people due to systemic health inequalities and generations of harm and broken treaty promises by the U.S. government. North and South Dakota now lead the country for COVID rates per capita. Government officials there have not taken the virus seriously, which has led to community spread. As elders are losing their lives to the virus, Native communities are facing another crisis, language extinction. Last year, there were only 230 Native Dakota and Lakota speakers on the Standing Rock Reservation. Jay and Cheryl Taken Alive were very active members of the Standing Rock community. They would have celebrated their 46th wedding anniversary on January 2nd. Cheryl was a social worker and helped families recover from trauma. She passed on November 11th. She was 64. Her husband, Jay, spent 24 years on the Standing Rock Tribal Council. He was an advocate of tribal treaty rights and dedicated his life to preserving the Lakota language and culture. He was a Lakota language teacher until his passing. He taught from the teepee that was outside of his house. He passed on December 14th. He was 65. Here is Jay Taken Alive speaking in April of 2016, and this is a clip from the Lakota Language Consortium.
The language comes from the Creator, so it doesn't belong to one of us. The language belongs to all of us. So my message to all of the young people, the young man, the young women, the boys, the girls, this is your language. When you learn it, you're going to be able to learn more about this beautiful thing called life, because that comes from Wakantanka, the opportunity to share your feelings, to share your thoughts, to express yourself, comes with our language. And I ask you to take the courage. Bilhech apo a da komini apetu wiji iuha a lakote api waglakakte. Chake he wowi chala bluhailo. I believe that there will be a day that all of you will talk. Na iotaha dona we chintala wea. Hey, dona we koska la kana wea. Dona e apetu wiji a Nija wakaja we chalo hakte. To hunt humpi hatanash, la kotia pi al otroke nach unkte. Finally, in closing, I ask you to do this on behalf of all of us who are older than you. Take the courage to learn the language.
And that was Jay Taken Alive, who was a Lakota language teacher until his passing on December 14th. His wife, Cheryl, also passed from COVID on November 11th. Jay and Cheryl are the parents of Nola Taken Alive, a Standing Rock Sioux tribal council member. The tribe is prioritizing vaccinations for elders and those who speak the language. Nola Taken Alive has also done very important work with young people. Hi, Nola. Thank you so much for joining us. And we're so, so sorry about what happened to your parents.
Thank you. Hamadakia pi hochoka luta wi machia pi iyo waslata imataha. Good afternoon. I thank you for having me on. My name is Nola Taken Alive. My Lakota name is Red Altar Woman. I come from Standing Rock. And I just want to say thank you for giving me this honor. But I also want to send my condolences out to the hundreds, thousands of people who are suffering with grief because of COVID. And of course, I also want to say that, you know, I apologize for my elders for speaking on behalf. It's really tough to speak on behalf of my dad, who, of course, anyone who's gotten a chance to meet my dad or visit with my dad held a lot of wealth of information from cultural knowledge, traditions, our ceremonies to our treaties. So thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you so much, Nola. And I have to say, because of social media, I feel like in some ways I know so much about you and your community now because people have posted so many photos and videos and remembrances of your parents. The PBS NewsHour is remembering people every Friday, and they also remembered your parents. Can you just give us a sense of, you know, what this means to the community, because they were so active, such active members of the Standing Rock community?
Yes. So first of all, I just want to say my parents were very, very humble people. And to speak of them in this manner, you know, I'm positive that my parents would, you know, mention that, you know, we're very, very humbled and we're so grateful to all the people. I know when my dad was sick after my mother had passed, you know, we got a chance to be with my dad while he was in a hospital. And I, you know, I wanted to remind my dad, you know, because he was so heartbroken over my mother's passing, you know, I said, you know, Dad, so many people are praying for you. There's hundreds of people. And he broke down, you know, in tears and in gratitude and touched his heart. And he patted his heart and said, how do I repay them? You know, that was the type of humility that my parents, both of them, had carried, and the respect that they had for many people. And, you know, just that little video, that clip that you had just played, you know, it's sinking in, you know, for a lot of us, you know, that, you know, he was, you know, they were both a big part of our community, the work that they did for many of our relatives. And my dad always stressed that, you know, to speak of our people as our relatives, you know, take care of each other, have that compassion for everyone. And I think, you know, like you had mentioned, the news, the stories that have been brought up on my dad. I know the former governor of North Dakota had mentioned that about my dad. He called him a spiritual warrior, and how my dad could, you know, disagree with the state. As tribal, he was our tribal chairman. He could disagree with him, but yet at the end of the meeting or at the end of the day, he could be friends with him and shake his hand and, you know, can continue on with life. So their work, my mother's work with, you know, especially our youth and families, you know, everyone remembers them for their kindness and, you know, even continuing on, you know, now is, it's hard for me to speak of them in this manner just because I could hear them, you know, being so humble about everything.
You know, you also posted photos of them when they were younger and talked on social media just about what an amazing couple they were and some of the songs that they really loved. So it was also, you know, it was also just nice to also learn about that aspect of them, because while they did this incredible work, they're human beings, and it sounds like they were so in love with each other. They would have celebrated their 46th wedding anniversary on January 2nd.
Oh, definitely. They were definitely committed to each other. And, you know, even before Dad had passed, you know, he said that he and Mom had talked about whether if someone went first, either of them went first. They loved us, they loved our relatives, they loved the community so much that they wanted to, you know, they told each other stay and help, you know, help the children, help the Takojas, which is means grandchildren, help the people. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I don't think they realized how much in love they were with each other, that we as children, we believe, even though Dad suffered with the COVID, effective COVID, we believe that that's, you know, he passed of a broken heart. So yes, they were definitely in love with each other. Mm.
I understand that the tribe is now prioritizing vaccinations for elders and those who speak the languages. Is that right?
Yes, correct. So those were the first ones that were going to be in line, because the tribe, as Standing Rock, we've had a total of 24 deaths, and it hasn't even been an entire year. Mm. And a majority of those 24 deaths have been our elders. And we've also had a majority of those being Lakota and Dakota fluent speakers. You know, my Unchi was probably one of the first who passed away, which was my dad's aunt. But she was an avid teacher of our Lakota language for many, many years. I would say like 40 years, I would have to say. You know, she started her career out at UND and, you know, continued to write the language, and she pushed the language and encouraged it. And anyone who had questions for her, she was more than welcome. She never judged you, never shamed you. So she was one of the first ones. And so a lot of our deaths have been Lakota, Dakota language speakers.
And your dad was actually teaching the Lakota language right until his passing. He was teaching from the teepee that's outside of his house.
Yeah. So after he had retired from tribal council, he took a break there for a bit. And then he took a position at the McLaughlin High School as their Lakota teacher, culture teacher. And when the pandemic started, you know, there was the back and forth whether we should be in school or out of school. And of course, we did the whole social distance thing and learning from the internet. But Dad, he still continued to, he always wanted that connection, to have that connection with everything, with Mother Earth and the teachings behind the teepee. And so he had his own teepee. He set it up beside his house and he ran an extension cord out to his teepee. And he took his laptop out there and he taught from Zoom from his teepee. And I remember stopping in there a couple of times because, you know, he would help me with my children as I'd have to go to work and they would be on Zoom as well. And I'll miss that, you know, I'll miss seeing that such love and passion that he had for our way of life, our what we call our beautiful way of life. And even though, you know, during a pandemic, even though it was through computers and laptops, he still wanted that connection with everything, with Mother Earth, with the air environment. So that was really, he always believed that our language was spiritual. And his three favorite, you know, his two favorite words that I can reiterate for him is Blihechi Apo. From a man's perspective, he would say Blihechi Apo, which means take courage. Or in his other favorite word, he would say is have that wowichala, which meant to believe. It's like a deep spiritual belief that you already know what's going to happen and you have that with your prayers, and to have that wowichala. You know, those were those two favorite words that he would use in Lakota to all of our people. Blihechi Apo and wowichala. Take courage and believe.
That is Nola Taken Alive, a Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council member. She recently lost her parents, Jay and Cheryl, to COVID, and I hope you can take some time to read about them, the work that they've done, what they meant to their community, and we've got a number of other articles at yourcallradio.org about efforts to save Native elders and Native languages. And now I would like to welcome Dr. Nayahet Gray Morning to the show. Dr. Gray Morning is professor in the Departments of Anthropology and Native American Studies at the University of Montana. Professor Gray Morning is a political anthropologist who studies Native American language maintenance and indigenous sovereignty issues. He is the editor of the book, Being Indigenous, Perspectives on Activism, Culture, Language, and Identity. And he is Arapaho and is passionate about preserving the language. Hi, Dr. Gray Morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Neake. Thank you.
Dr. Gray Morning, I just wonder, listening to Nola, what is going through your mind as we are sadly losing so many natives who speak elders? I mean, that's just, you know, so awful on its own, but also so many people who speak their native languages.
This is a convoluted question, and give it some perspective before I give an answer. When I entered college on the Wind River Reservation, there were roughly 3,800 Arapaho living on the reservation, and 50%, 2,000 of them spoke the language. Today, there are some 10,000 Arapaho, and there are probably less than 60 speakers that are on the reservation. The issue of language loss and losing elders has actually been with us since the 80s. People have been concerned about this throughout Indian country since the 80s. But that concern hasn't changed into or hasn't actually had much of an impact in creating new speakers. And part of the reason for that is a method. The methods that are being used often are methods that are copied from how people teach French, how people teach Spanish, and anyone that has taken one of these classical languages in high school and college know that you really don't learn much through the methods that they use in high school and college. You learn some things, but if you go to the country, you really can't speak the language. And that's part of the problem that you find in a lot of places. What's being taught are how to count animal names, colors, some expressions here, some expressions. Often they are things like, I love you. Can I go to the bathroom? Can I have a drink of water? I'm hungry. And it's fairly consistent in a lot of places, not everywhere, but a lot of places. This is what's being taught. And part of the reason why those things are being taught in so many different places is the people who are doing that and teaching the language have in their heads that their language is so complicated that the people they're teaching aren't learning it, but they're not learning it because of the method. And the biggest thing in that is people are trying to memorize how to speak language, and no child memorizes how to speak their first language.
Well, to that point, Nola, how did your dad teach the Lakota language? And can you just talk about the process? Was it through a class? Was it mostly students? Can you tell us more about that?
Actually, I was looking through some of my notes from the discussion that my dad and I had back in September of 2020. And I've also done some work around meditation, and we've had discussions around this, and just to add on to, you know, some of the issues that we're having as far as losing the languages, you know, we discussed, Dad and I talked about, you know, the broken treaties and how does that even relate to that. But if you look at it, back when I was in high school, you know, I grew up around the ceremonies, I grew up around the language, but I'm not fluent. And I tried to understand, you know, when I got to high school, I remember I went to mostly a non-native school, and a non-native male had made the remark to me, you know, you guys are a bunch of drunks. And I was like, I tried to think about, like, what was my comeback? And because my mind immediately went to the street of our community. And I did see a lot of individuals or relatives who did have drinking problem or who were addicted to alcohol. So how did I go from what was my comeback? But it wasn't until I got to college and I really understood, like, what actually happened to our people, the oppression and the genocide, the attempted genocide that happened to our people. And for a moment there, I was very angry. You know, I was very angry at anyone who was not Dakota or Lakota. You know, I kind of had bitterness to me until I actually got back into the field and got to work on myself and talked about forgiveness. But you think about this on a larger scale on how, what has the federal government, what have they done, you know, to oppress us? And our own people don't even understand, you know, like, this doesn't come from us. But once we start understanding where all this historical trauma comes from, where, how did this happen, all the shame and the guilt, and then I really feel that once we start healing from all of that, we can come back to, like, looking at how beautiful we really are, how beautiful and spiritual our language really is. And I always encourage young people, you know, it's the non-native world, you know, throughout the world, they're saying meditation, but, you know, that comes from Lakota way of life. We've had that, you know, through our ceremonies, through our sun dances, through our going on a hill, a vision quest, and so forth. But once we start that healing process, we can actually start believing in ourselves, because when you're dealing with so much lateral oppression or depression, it's like the last thing that's on your mind is, I want to speak Lakota, or how do I even believe that I'm a beautiful Lakota person? So, you know, Dad and I had this discussion this past fall about, let's start healing. Let's start getting ourselves that relief that we all need, as not just Lakota, Dakota, but as human beings, so that we can start looking at things in a beautiful way, in a loving way. So when Dad taught, that's what he always encouraged to young people. He was always that encourager. Because sometimes, you know, he understood that a lot of our relatives, our nieces and nephews, and for him, his takojas, grandchildren, would come to school hungry or had just come back from the weekend of, you know, a lot of maybe violence or whatever it is, you know, and not feeling so well. So it was about making them feel good about themselves. Teaching them about how beautiful it is to be a Lakota person, or from our Lakota perspective, we come from the band of Hunkpapas, which was Sitting Bull's band, and to remind them that blood still flows through you. So it was more so about encouraging and lifting their spirits up, to remind them of who they were, so that they can learn, so that they can take pride in one or two sentences. You know, and he would teach through song, you know, because he would sing, and he really encouraged the young ladies, because they were so shy in the beginning. But if you see them, you know, they would all stand around the drum, you know, during a basketball game, you would have a group of young men singing, just now learning. And then you would have a bunch of young ladies standing around that circle. So it was giving them that power. But yeah, that's just a little bit about Dad. And we also, he also believed that too. One of his favorite quotes is, it's better to build up a child than to repair an adult. So that mm-hmm. was always where his focus was our young people, our beautiful young people.
Hmm. Well, it is so beautiful. And I know that I read an article about the work that you have done with youth, and are you planning to continue that work in the honor of your parents in the years to come?
Oh, definitely. Actually, I was just visiting with my daughter. She's like 24 now, and we're talking about, you know, some of the youth memories that we had, and, you know, they keep my spirit going, and I work on behalf of them, because they just have that type of mentality and that spirit of, I can change the world, and I can change the reservation. As opposed to, you know, when they get to adults and they get pushed down, or no, that's not a good idea, or no, we tried that already, you know. But if you take a look at what changed the world and what has sparked this whole healing process, if you look at the whole No Dapple issue, where did that start? Where did that awareness start? And it started from a group of young people, a group of youth, who wanted to change the world, and like they knew that this wasn't right, that our water could be damaged. And so they themselves took it upon themselves to bring this awareness to the world. So they were the spark, actually, that brought many tribes together, and also united the world on this issue of climate change and taking care of our environment, taking care of it from a spiritual perspective. And I'm really anxious that, you know, Dad always said, you never trust a federal government, but I have a little bit of hope in Biden administration, you know, when he's looking at climate change. And he said that before he even became, you know, when he was campaigning, you know, about the oil industry, the, you know, so I have a little bit of hope. And I also, you know, Dad always pushed, you know, the prophecy of the seventh generation, that everything that was taken from us will be returned. So we just, I feel like I have to continue to push that from Dad's perspective, from my teachings, from my ancestors' teachings, believing in that. And then how are we going to do that? How do I continue to clear the pathway for our younger generations to be able to speak the language, to heal, to change the world, you know? So,
yeah, those are such beautiful words from your father. And Nola, again, we're so sorry about what happened to your parents. And I have to say, it really was amazing to learn more about you, your family, and your community. And we'd love to have you back and maybe connect you on the show with some youth. And we can just talk about, you know, efforts to continue what it will take to heal and really change things. So thank you so much for joining us to remember your parents. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my honor.
Nola Taken Alive is a council member with the Standing Rock Sioux, and her parents, Jay and Cheryl, were very active members of the Standing Rock community. Her mother, Cheryl, passed on November 11th. She was 64. And her dad, Jay, passed on December 14th. He was 65. And I hope you can take some time to read about their work at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with Professor Gray Morney, who is a professor in the Departments of Anthropology and Native American Studies at the University of Montana. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about COVID in Indian Country and efforts to save elders and native speakers. Today, we're joined by Dr. Nayahet Graymorning, professor in the Departments of Anthropology and Native American Studies at the University of Montana, and editor of the book Being Indigenous, Perspectives on Activism, Culture, Language, and Identity. Professor Graymorning is Arapaho. Today there are over 10,000 Arapaho people, but less than 60 speakers. Professor Graymorning, I just wonder what your thoughts are about what Nola Taken Alive just said. That it's so interesting when you think about youth especially learning about the past and then moving forward, healing, learning their language, perhaps getting involved and making their community better. I wonder how you talk to your students about these issues.
Well, I could answer that directly, but I'll answer it in a different way. I've been teaching Arapaho at the university since 2005. I purposefully structured that so that I only teach it on Mondays and Wednesdays, and roughly the students get 65 minutes of instruction per class. So roughly a little over 2 hours. We just finished our fifth hour of instruction, and the students are on a pace where they are learning a new phrase every 3 minutes of instruction. I'm at a point where I can say to the class, Anatohina Bechake, or Hitosta Bechake, what is the lion doing? And they will know and answer, Yeneyanot Naku. He's chasing a rabbit. And I'll ask, Anato Yeneyanot Hinanaku, why is he chasing that rabbit? And they'll say, Nachehi Hasnat. Maybe he's hungry. I'll ask a question. And they'll go, Nayat. Well, they'll say, and I'll go, Anato. And they'll say, Nahehi, Nawo'u, Hanina with thee, Nayetche. So this is at 5 hours. And this is only a fraction of what students are actually able to do in the language. But you don't see that happening across Indian country. You don't even see that happening in classical language classes. I've been told by people that teach classical languages that when they observe what the students are doing after 10 hours of instruction in my classroom, that they have said those students seem to be performing at a proficiency level of what a student performs at after 2 years of instruction in classical languages. Mm. So my response is, when students start learning their language, they take on a whole different perspective of how they feel about themselves. There is a gap in most students that they want to fill. That gap comes with identity, with language, and language brings identity. And knowing that you're native and yet you don't speak your language has a strong impact on one's psyche. But knowing that you're native and you speak your language, or you're at a point where you are gaining ground and actually speaking your language, that is an empowering thing. Hmm.
It is so empowering. And hearing you talk about how fast the students are learning this language is incredible. We were watching videos with your students who are learning the Arapaho language in less than 10 years because of the tool that you created, the accelerated second language acquisition.
Let me correct that. I'm sorry. Less than 10 hours.
10 hours. Okay. So tell us more about this tool. How did you come up with this?
Well, actually in ceremony, a lot of prayers. And the question in ceremony always was, how do I find that key to open this door? How do I find something that can match the pace of language loss with a tool? And year after year, I would go into that ceremony, and 1 year, something happened. And I started really paying attention to how mothers talk to their children when the children were quite young, at airports and things like that. I think the biggest epiphany that I had, though, after I actually had developed the method, and so the method is developed in a way that children learn language naturally. But the biggest epiphany that I had was when, in watching parents, I realized children actually understand an enormous amount of language before they ever speak. You see a toddler, and a parent tells the toddler, go get my glasses off the table. And the toddler will toddle over and start fumbling around. Every parent knows this. And I sat back and thought, how is this possible? It's not like there's these structured classes that happens with this child. And all of a sudden, that's why this is happening. And this is what gives us the impression about this idea that children are sponges for language. But my response to that some 15 years ago was, well, if children are sponges for our languages, how come that they're not learning our language? And it goes back to method. So the key to what I do first lays on comprehension. And I can have a student comprehend some of the most complicated sentences in a matter of seconds. And what some teachers don't understand is to get them to understand things sometimes that they don't know, I can actually give them something more complicated, and all of a sudden they understand what's going on. And all of this is happening in the language.
Wow. I want to ask you a general question, because when you do research about, you know, tribes and languages, the numbers are all over the board. Do we know how many native languages were spoken before Europeans arrived?
It's most commonly believed that there were a minimum of 500, but that's based on limited observation and some guesswork. Mm-hmm. There could have been in North America, there probably were anywhere from 600 to 800 different languages. But I shouldn't say some of those are dialects, but because in linguistic studies, they group things in family groups like Algonquian, these aren't dialects. People that speak Blackfoot, Cheyenne, Cree, they're all part of the Algonquian family, but they're not mutually intelligible between different speakers. In Cree, the word for duck is sisip, and that happens to be very close to Arapaho, sisich. So this is how they group these families together when they find these commonalities, but it doesn't mean you understand the person's language. Mm-hmm. And so I suspect that when we look at it that way, it could be anywhere between 600 and 800 different languages prior to contact.
How many are spoken today?
Less than 140, and that's on the high side. By some account, it's probably less than 120. And this is the problem with waiting for ideal situations to happen. As you're waiting for that, I was a reader for native languages, for grants, administration for native Administration for Native Americans, I think that's what ANA stood for. And a lot of people would wait and compete for this money to try to save their language. And while that was happening, they were losing speakers all the time. Right. And that's part of the reason why I developed this method, because we cannot afford to wait for these ideal situations. The Maori understood this really well. They didn't wait for money. They started teaching like Nola's father, they started teaching language out of their garage in various places, but they created second language speakers. And you may have read the article that I sent with the community that I worked with in Australia. They were down to their last fluent speaker. And I worked with them. They wound up developing 10 people who could speak the language, who then became teachers of the language. And those 10 people are now teaching 700 people from preschool to adults. So it's a matter of numbers. Mm. And Clark's daughter, who 4 years ago could not speak at all, well, she could say some things. She's now 2 years behind what she can say in English, she can say in her native language. So that means if she's 10 years old now, she is speaking at a level of in her language of how she spoke when she was 8 years old in English. And Clark says all we do now is we sit around, me, his wife, and I mean Clark, his wife, and his daughter, and they just speak.
Wow, that's incredible. Can we also talk about how this happened? I mean, it wasn't just that people passed. In a New York Times op-ed, Jody Archambault of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe wrote, quote, that we still have Lakota speakers at all is a miracle. Earlier generations were removed from their land and families to boarding schools that beat children for speaking their native tongue, and more recently to classrooms that nearly erased their Lakota culture, end quote. And Professor Graymorning, you know, just doing research for the show, I was thinking about my own great-grandmother, who is Pomo, or was Pomo, from what is now Northern California. And she wrote about what happened to her language. When she was in a boarding school, she was beaten for speaking. And so she never taught it to her children, and it died in boarding school overnight. And I remember my grandma, I was just thinking about this, reading a story about, I forgot what tribe it is, but they said, we don't have any words for bad words. Well, my grandma knew a couple of bad words in her language, and she taught those to us, but they didn't know that many. And it's amazing to think that a language could die so fast And so my grandmother doesn't know it. And as a result, my dad and I don't know it other than a few words.
Yeah. And that's what happens in the process. People. So in preparing for this, I was thinking about this scenario. If a family member has somebody who is ill and they take that person to a doctor and the doctor says, well, you know what? There's not much we can do for them. Usually what happens is the family member doesn't accept that and they take that person to another doctor. This is what happened with Lorenzo's oil. So Lorenzo's parents, so Lorenzo had a genetic condition where these fatty cells developed around his nervous system, and so it didn't fire properly, and it's horribly debilitating. His father was a banker, and his mother was a linguist. They did not have any medical skills, and they kept getting rejection out of rejection out of rejection from each doctor saying there's nothing we can do. He persisted. Him and his wife persisted, and they developed Lorenzo's oil. And that's what usually happens. But with the language, which is ill and needs to be healed, people still go to a method that is classically used with French and German and all these classical languages that really don't work. And so because it doesn't work, the language is reduced more and more down to memorizing things like numbers and colors.
Hmm.
And this is the big problem. The nuances of language is incredible. And we don't realize that. I've seen more of this as a result of reading students' essays in English and seeing how they put things together and changing one word. And then all of a sudden we just automatically know how to change the rest of the sentence without even thinking about it. At least this stuff happens in every language. And we don't think about those nuances. And that's why it's important to have the language to reach a certain point with the language and have it spoken in a community so you can hear those things. And once that stops happening, we start getting an acceleration of language loss. So we need to accelerate actual language competence and proficiency so that people know they can use the language. So I had, I won't put it this way, but one of the things that happens is the technology that we have comes at staggering speeds. And it's fortunate, it's interesting that in Arapaho, there's only two borrowed words in the entire language. We have words for television, we have words for X-ray machine, we have words for computer, for computer, which means it is knowledgeable, which I don't totally agree with, but that's the word for it. So we have all of these words. It's only as knowledgeable as what we put into it, but you know, it's there. So we have all of these words, and the students in my class learn all of these things, but they don't learn them in isolation. They learn 16 words as single words, and the rest of everything that they learn happens in full sentences. And they get from that point into storytelling, which you saw online. And they reach the storytelling point probably after about 14 hours to 15 hours of instruction. They're learning stories. But they don't learn those stories in English. They never hear an English translation. The last thing they have to do is translate the story into English.
So you're teaching this at the University of Montana. Do you know how many schools are teaching native languages? Is this becoming more available in community centers, for example? Any idea?
Well, it's difficult in community centers. There's difficulty even on reservations. Many schools on reservations are controlled by the city or the county or the state, and they set a curriculum. So you see, you have a situation where you have sovereignty on a reservation, But that sovereignty is undermined because the school district says, no, you can only have 15 minutes to teach your language. Hmm. And that's not possible. And when I was hired to direct a program, a retention program to try to figure out how to keep children in school, I went to the principal and I said, what would happen if you gave me 15 minutes from the English teacher and 15 minutes from the biology teacher, and I could use that to teach the language? And he said, well, that would reduce the amount of time that the English teacher would have and the biology teacher would have. And I said, yeah, and what would that do? And he said, well, they wouldn't be able to teach their subject matter. And I said, then why are you doing it to us? And so I got that time. I said, this is a reservation. You know,
wow.
I want that time. And I got it, but it didn't come with a fight. And they never saw children learn. So I got it with the kindergarten students. And I also we had three different kindergarten classes, and I got five children from each one of those classes. And they never saw children learn the level of language that they learned in that one semester from, I think, January to May. It wasn't a significant amount of language. But that's what happens. We've had our languages colonized, and it continues to be colonized to present day. People try to fight for their language, and they're told, sorry, it's not important. We're not going to give you money for it, because they are controlled by curriculum that's set outside of the reservation, that's then brought onto the reservation, and they have to live by those codes. And as a result, languages are disappearing. And people forget the role that language speakers played in World War II.
Yes. I was just watching a film about that. That is so important. The code talkers, there's some really great documentaries about that. You have said that Canada, Australia, and New Zealand have actually invested billions into language preservation and revitalization. Is that right?
Well, if I take all of those together, billions, but each one, millions, not billions.
Okay, but they're actually spending money to preserve languages.
Oh, yeah. I think 4 years ago, Canada allocated something close to $50 million for language. And in Australia, I believe that's around the same amount. It might actually be $80 million. But the thing that happened in Australia is they are looking for bilingualism. They don't want immersion schools. And people don't understand, when you're teaching through bilingualism, through English and the language, what happens is you are always translating to the dominant language. And because that's the language that people are speaking, that's their first language, the language that they're trying to learn is just filtered out. And that's why people go, well, they never remember anything. That's a key word, trying to get them to remember. You shouldn't be teaching through memory, through memorization, but bilingualism doesn't work. The reason why bilingualism worked in the U.S. is because it was done with Spanish-speaking community who are trying to learn English. And so they're surrounded with English. And that's why it worked. But it's not going to work in the other direction, where you're surrounded by English and you have a target language that is small that you're trying to get a community to learn, when their first language already is English.
We don't have time to go into this article because we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to mention Rebecca Nagel wrote a piece in High Country News called "The U.S. Has Spent More Money Erasing Native Languages Than Saving Them." And she writes that the U.S. has allocated $12 million annually to tribes working to preserve their languages, thanks to the Esther Martinez Native American Languages Preservation Act. But in 2018, only 47 language projects received funding. That was just 29%. So two-thirds of the applicants did not get the funding. And you can find that piece at yourcallradio.org. And I just wonder, in our final minutes, Professor Graymorning, what changes do you see in your students who learn their native language?
Oh, they are. It's they hunger for the language. They get upset with me because I only teach it twice a week. And I explain, well, I do this because of what the reality is off the reservation. But I want to add to that statistic because I put a statistic out some 15 years ago that during the boarding school period, just in the Northwest Territories, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, in a 50-year period from the 1880s into the 1930s, the United States government spent $250 million to eradicate Native cultures and languages. Mm. And that is according to what the currency was worth at that period of time. So if we look at it in today's standards, it's probably going to be close to $1 billion if we ramped it up. But what I said before, when students know they can use their language, if you think about it, we don't spend our time, and I say this often too, we don't spend our time in a discussion going around. You don't have a discussion if you go cow, brown, three. But it's raining, and I love my mother. Discussions don't happen like that. But the class just learned something just the other day, which was very abstract, where I had them learn. Well, I said in Arapaho, and the class busted out laughing. And what I said was, a frog is swimming butterfly. And it was really funny for them to hear that, but they understood. And I don't care what language you're teaching, French, German, whatever, students aren't going to hear that kind of stuff.
Right.
But I can teach these abstractions and students get it right off. Mm. Right off. I mean, I could say, and students know what that means. A man is reading the paper, sitting on a chair in front of windows.
Hmm.
That's what's needed to save languages.
Right. Well, you know, Professor Gray Morning, your students are so lucky to have you. You sound like an amazing teacher, and I bet you all have a lot of fun in the classroom.
Oh, we do. I mean, yeah. I'll walk across tabletops, desktops, to prove a point. I mean, to get them to understand something.
Well, I'm so glad that we had you on the show. It's been great to meet you. We'd love to have you back. And thank you so much for the great work that you do. And that stat that you just shared about boarding schools, we're going to have to do a show about boarding schools. I mean, that says it all. $250 million, and then today a measly $12 million to preserve languages.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, have to change the priorities. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me on.
Thank you. Dr. Neahet Gray Morning is professor in the Departments of Anthropology and Native American Studies at the University of Montana. Find out more about his important work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.